The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk, episode 468, to be broadcast on Wednesday, January 14th, 2026, on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. Mm-hmm. If you're watching on Facebook Live, please feel free to comment, and she or I might be able to respond to us. To you. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show and are listening on Facebook Live, you can comment right down here below, or you can, if you're listening to this on an audio file, you can comment by writing to bicycletalk1@gmail.com. And I will try to get back to you. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ron's Rant of the Week. Oh, all right, there we go. We're not going to look at what just happened. When a motorized vehicle is deemed a deadly weapon. Yeah, this is my rant. Unless you live under a rock, you're aware of the fact that there was a national event with an ICE agent last week and the driver of a minivan / SUV. The bad news is obvious and tragic. If there could be any good news out of all this, it appears that law enforcement now considers a motorized vehicle a deadly weapon. Huh. Gee, haven't I been talking about this for the last, like, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years? I don't know. Anyway, as a bicycle advocate, I have been preaching this for years. Even though it appears this driver had no intention of using her car as a weapon, a decision was made that she was. The decision did not appear to be that of the motorized vehicle driver. As a Vision Zero advocate, it's rare to hear a powerful government leader decry an act of aggressive driving in this way, and disturbing to hear it in response to how it appears from several separate analyses. Anyway, not to be an act of aggression at all, but a woman fleeing a crowd of armed masked men who had reached into her car. A sad day and time in our country, for sure. And I'm going to throw this one out. Here's a teaser. New Jersey S4834/A6235. We'll talk about that more in the show. On a positive side, Happy New Year. Hey, we are back. We're back from Florida. Last week, you got an encore episode, we'll call it, of Bicycle Talk on the radio. And so now we are back, and we're back in the present. Fran and I went to Florida, and yeah, we got warm, and it was really cool. It was really cool to get warm. Very nice. Anyway, wonderful weather, great cycling weather. We have bikes down there waiting for us, so we got a chance to get out and ride almost every day that we were there, which is really nice. And then, of course, we'll talk a little bit more about the not so really nice, but that's all right. We'll get there. So that's a positive on the positive side. And then on the positive side, not all all cyclists are bad. The Soudal Quick-Step riders interrupted a training ride to help a driver with a stuck car. More in the show. Mechanical Minute and Bike Tips. Here we go. And this comes to be the bad part of going to Florida. The cervical fusion blues. Yes, I have the cervical fusion blues. Yes, I do. So here's the thing. I had this work done, obviously. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you know what's going on here. I have a small bridge that's built in the back of my neck, which makes me now upright again and also able to function without turning into a recipient of a wheelchair for the rest of my life. So there's the good news, right? That's always good news. But the bad news is, you know what? It just doesn't feel right on my bike. So we were down in Florida the first day, and I have an older Bianchi road bike, which I have converted over to work for me, to fit me. And of course, it doesn't fit me anymore because of my neck. And the fact is that we went out on the first day on the bikes, and I was able to look down, but not really able to look up. So as long as I stayed within range of Fran's rear wheel, I could sort of be comfortable while I was riding my bike. But if she had stopped quickly in front of me, I would have had a hard time seeing that. So that's not a safe way to ride. And also, I've got some range of motion in the turn to the right and to the left. So seeing traffic when you're in traffic, and we were in a lot of traffic, by the way, if you're interested to know, the section of Florida that we were in, which is generally not that busy because it's on the West Coast, it was ridiculous this year. Fran and I were both commenting on the increase in traffic and population in that area. It's Venice, Florida, by the way, if you're looking for where we were. The good news was it was really warm out. It was really nice. It was in the 70s every day, and we even hit 80 a couple of days. So big break from leaving Connecticut at 5 to 15 degrees in the morning. That's not so good. But anyway, so that part was good. So let's talk about the cervical fusion just a little bit. All right. They say that you can usually return to cycling after a cervical fusion, but it requires gradual doctor-approved process, starting with gentle stationary rides after a few weeks and progressing to outdoor biking. Avoiding aggressive positions or impacts that allow fusion to allow the fusion to solidify and prevent nerve irritation or hardware failure, most patients can return to full activity, but your bike fit adjustments like raising the handlebars and avoiding high impact extreme riding like mountain biking are often necessary long term. So what did I do? The first thing I did was I went to the ever so friendly next day service and had a stem shipped out to Fran's mom's apartment or condominium. And it showed up the next day, and I put a very geeky-looking tall stem that has absolutely no reach out on it whatsoever. And that made a huge difference because now I'm sitting straight up, and I can see forward a little bit, but it's still not right. This is going to take some time to get used to it. So the focus is now to start strengthening the deep neck muscles with isometric exercises and maintaining a chin tuck when doing all the usual upper body weight training stuff. So that's what I'm hoping for, and I'll keep you guys abreast to the issue because as I have looked this up, I see there's even a Facebook page that's dedicated to this. It's crazy stuff out there, but apparently I'm not the only one with neck surgery or, you know, other people that have severely broken their necks and yet they're still back and riding their bikes again. The one issue that seems to be, or let's say the one solution that seems to be out there unanimously amongst everyone is to get off of those drop bars and move yourself up to flat bars. I don't like that idea a lot, but I am stubborn and I will see what I can do about not going there. Right now I am going there and I do have some upright bar bicycles and I will be using those as I work my way into the spring. And I just ordered yet another stem for a hybrid bike, which I had recently fixed up. Very nice hybrid bike, actually. It's a high-level, high-quality bike. And it's an adjustable stem. So I'm going to play with that because then I can, you know, maybe as I get stronger and feel more comfortable, I can always bring the angle down a little bit, but I'm going to look downright stupid while riding my bike for outside for a while. But at this point, I'll be riding my bike outside, so that's a good thing. And it's going to be a little while until that happens anyway, so I'm not too worried about what this is going to do as far as my ability to ride. I will say that in Florida, it was the best I can say is I was uncomfortable at best. So not great. I'll get there. I have to work on these deep neck muscle strengthening exercises and see if I can get that a little bit better so that my neck feels a little bit better. I have been given clearance by my doctor to do whatever I want. So he feels that everything is very well fused now. It's been 6 months, and hopefully that will help me. In the meantime, I am going to try to increase my cycling power, and I have some exercises that I can go over with you on this. So let's go there right now and talk about it. So these are workouts that will help you build your strength and your, if you need it for speed or strength or whatever. Pretty simple stuff. You know, if you take a look at a pedal stroke and you compare it to a clock, the right half of the clock from 12 to 6 is your power phase. When you push down on the pedal to propel forward, the left from the 6 to 12 is more like the recovery phase. And when you're returning to the top of that clock, you'll need to pull up on the second phase of the pedal stroke. Each phase is equally important when it comes to increasing cycling power. However, many cyclists tend to solely focus on practicing exercises that strengthen the power phase rather than both. In order to reach your full potential, you need a balanced routine that will target all the muscles you recruit as you pedal. I am beginning next Sunday something we have dubbed as Extreme Spin at the local community center. It's an hour and a half cycling class, and I do start out by focusing on that full pedal stroke and reminding people that you have to put in the four components, the push through, the push down, the pull back, and the pull up of your pedal stroke, so you can use more of your hamstrings and your hip flexors. And this is like really important if you want to smooth out that pedal stroke. Winter is for not necessarily getting out in the cold unless you're very hardy, but it is that time when you can actually do some major improvements on your position on your bike, on your pedal stroke, and your technique that you're using on your bike. It's really a great time to try to work on increasing your cadence on the bike, but also increasing your cadence in a powerful way. So there's a lot of things you could do to work on that over the winter time, and that's really what you're looking for. But if you really want to do it right, you really need to do some things off the bike. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that today. And we're going to talk about some things you can do to help get yourself back into a little bit more of a strong position as far as that goes. Franny's been doing the chair seats against the walls. I know she's been doing those. And yes, those can be a really good time. You know, it doesn't take a lot, 20 seconds really of time, where you put yourself in a seated position with your back against the wall. You can also use an exercise ball in between the wall and your back if you want to really add some challenge into it. And so you can do that. But really, what you need in order to do anything here is you need a chair, a mini resistant band, and a mat and a set of dumbbells. They're kind of helpful for this sort of thing. So the first one is what they call a rear elevated split squat, and try to explain this on an audio show here. So you start in a split stance with the right foot elevated on bench or chair, and to add an extra challenge, you can hold a set of dumbbells in each hand. Engage your core by drawing your belly button towards your spine, bend both knees to lower into a lunge position, front knee over your ankle and back knee hovering just above the floor. So you're dropping down and you're pulling yourself back up. So you're kind of like doing a dip with one foot on the chair and or bench. And then you go like 8 reps on one leg, 8 reps on the other leg, and then as many as you can manage. Remember, if you're getting into any kind of a weight training regimen, you want to go slow at first, go easy. Don't just jump in and go, okay, I'm going to do, you know, four sets of these. And start with one set, see how you feel. Move on. Next time you go to workout, do it again. But maybe then you want to add an extra set in. So be real careful about overdoing it, because if you overdo it, you're going to get discouraged. If you're discouraged, you're not going to continue to do it. So you're not going to get where you need to go. The next one is called the Renegade Row. And how to do it? You hold a pair of dumbbells and you start in a high plank position. So kind of like you're doing a push-up, but you've got weights down by your hands. And then you simply hold yourself in that plank position, but you lift one of the weights up and then place the weight back down onto the floor. You do 6 reps on each side. And again, as many as you can do or cannot do is all you really do. And I actually tried these this morning, and I found that I have to use some pretty light weights to do this. I'm not really that strong yet, so I got a ways to go. But anyway, that's a great way. And what that's going to work on, it's going to work on your core, and your core strength, of course, is really, really important for your cycling. So probably more important than you realize. There's also something called a single leg Romanian deadlift. You do those, Fran?
I have in the past.
Yeah. So you start with standing with feet hip width apart, a dumbbell in each hand. With that slight bend in the left knee, lift the right foot up off the floor and keeping your back flat on the floor. Hinge at the hips and send your hip straight back and bring your torso near parallel to the floor while lifting the right leg behind you. Drive through the left foot to stand back up. Repeat for 8 reps and then switch legs and do another 8 reps. So those can be also challenging. All this is very easy to find. If you're looking for explanation on this, there are great YouTube videos out there. So that would be the third one, which is the single leg Romanian deadlift. Dead bug, one of Fran's favorites. You like the dead bug,
dead
don't
bug.
You?
Yes, you like dead bug. With weights.
So you lie on the floor with your face up and your feet lifted and your knees bent over your hips and your arms extended straight up over your shoulders, like a dead bug. Got it? Draw the belly button in to flatten the back to the floor and bring the rib cage down toward the hips to engage your core. That's your starting position. Keeping your core tight, extend your right leg and left arm until they hover just above the floor. Hard, very hard, by the way. 12 reps per side. And once again, this is all going to strengthen a lot of core here, so you're really going to be working on some good stuff with your core, which will help you get stronger seated on the bike. Also, it'll keep your position a little bit better on the bike, which is nice. Single leg hamstring curl. You lie face up, arms down by your sides and calves, on top of a stability ball. Oh yeah, they didn't mention the stability ball. If you don't know what that is another interesting inflatable piece of torture that you can suspend yourself on, which will make you work harder than you thought you ever were going to work. They're definitely tricky. So you tuck your hips flat to flatten back onto the floor, squeeze your glutes, lift your hips, extend your left leg up off the ball, balance on the right leg, and then use the right heel to pull the ball towards the glutes while keeping the hips lifted. So you're rolling the ball forward with your foot and then rolling it back. It's very tricky. 8 reps, switch legs. There you go. And then the last one that we have listed here, and I'm gonna try to do these, and I'll give you a little bit of a feedback next week when I'm on the show as to how I made out. And hopefully I didn't injure myself in any way or anything. But anyway, this is where you lie face up with a mini band looped around the tops of your feet, legs straight. Drive the left heel into the ground and pull the toes of the right foot up. Drive the knee toward in towards your chest like you're marching. Straighten your leg and repeat both sides 15 to 20 reps. So you're kind of drawing with resistance your leg back towards your body. And then, of course, rest for 60 seconds and repeat that entire circuit for 3 sets. I would not do that at first. I would probably do 1 set just to start with and see how you feel, and then evaluate from that point as to where you need to go. This is hard stuff. It's a lot harder than it looks, so you have to kind of do everything with caution, is what I tell people. So anyway, that's something you can do to increase your cycling power. There's lots of stuff out there. If you're looking for specifics, there's a number of different videos out there that will show you different things, the different ideas as far as that go. So let's move on to not all cyclists are bad. I love this article. This is just a great piece. So the Soudal Quickstep riders were out on a training ride, and the members of the Belgian squad helped push a vehicle back onto the road. So joking that it probably wouldn't be possible with just a bunch of climbers. So anyway, they're on the roads around Calpe and Alicante. They're awash with cyclists at training camps at this time of year. And that was a blessing for one car driver on Friday who found, this was just this past Friday, who found roadside assistance in the form of a professional cycling team. A group of the Soudal Quickstep riders came to the aid of a stranded driver outside of Calpe during their training ride on Friday, turning around to help push an older man's car back onto the road after the driver had seemingly collided with a brick wall on a downhill bend. The trio, there's a trio of videos out there on it, it's very funny, posted to Instagram, show the lycra-clad riders all pushing the bonnet of the car. I'm not reading an American site, am I? The bonnet. You know what the bonnet is, right? Fran, you know what the bonnet is, right?
The bonnet?
Yeah, the bonnet of a car.
The hood.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
In Britain.
So they're pushing the bonnet of the car to get the vehicle back on the road and the wheels spinning before finally finding traction again. So the squad's self-branded team, invoking the squad's self-branded team spirit, we turned around to help to get this man back on the road again. Isn't that great? I think that's a great story. I couldn't pass that one up. So, you know, not all cyclists are bad. They can actually help you when you're driving your motorized vehicle off the road and need some help getting it back on. So anyway, let's move on to something else here. Yeah, I wanted to talk about this Senate Bill 4834. So this comes from Pat Cunane, who is a bicycle advocate in the New Jersey area. I actually worked for Pat Cunane a number of years ago when he was with Fuji America, or what wasn't Fuji America then, it was called something else. But anyway, he's always been very, very active in bicycle advocacy and all. And so anyway, New Jersey has come up with this S4834/A6235. And it is basically, there was a problem with a 14-year-old boy in Union County who was struck while riding a vehicle that to media and most people is just an e-bike. But the vehicle here used here and most other crashes of this nature was somewhat very different. An electric moped or motorcycle or e-motor can go well over 30 miles an hour. The crash and others are heartbreaking reminders that road safety is sometimes a matter of life and death. As a father and grandfather, this person confirms that vehicles that can go as fast as 50 miles an hour under motor power are clearly motor vehicles and should not be used on the roads and by non-drivers, especially children. So, in an earnest attempt to prevent future tragedies, The New Jersey legislature is unfortunately pursuing a bill that is fundamentally flawed because it treats all Class 1 and 2 low-speed electric bikes that can only go up to 20 miles per hour as motor vehicles that require a driver's license, vehicle registration, and no-fault insurance coverage to operate. Give me a break. Anyway, it simply misidentifies the problem by focusing on lower speed electric bicycles that are not creating safety risks and leading to crashes. If it becomes law, this bill will create confusion and financial burdens for consumers and families that will most certainly harm the 300 plus bike retailers and rental businesses that form the backbone of New Jersey's cycling industry and community. Well, anyway, so if these bikes can go, Class 1, Class 2s can go up to 20 miles per hour, and if I am in a very fit place in my life and I can go that fast, what is the difference between me and an e-bike? I'm not happy with this. And obviously there's a whole bunch of people down in New Jersey that aren't real happy with this either, because where does it stop? Okay, if you have to license and register and then have insurance to be able to ride your bicycle on the road, that's not a good thing, folks. That's really, really not a good thing. Kind of takes away from the joy of being able to go out and use your bicycle for transportation and not have to pay enormous amounts of money to do so. But anyway, we shall see exactly where this is going to go. And I'm going to keep my eyes on this because it is, you know, improving safety is paramount for sure. But, having this be a beginning, let's say New Jersey passes this and it goes through, who's next? California? Who's next? Illinois? Chicago? Who knows? We don't know. So this is definitely a problem, and low-speed Class 1 and 2 e-bikes should not be swept up in a rush to address safety concerns and tragedies involving faster e-motos. Now, I will say that when Fran and I were down in Florida, there are some very fast e-bikes down in Florida, and they were scooting right along, and they were on the bicycle paths and trails, and that gets a little unnerving when you ride your bike and all of a sudden you can kind of hear the buzz of them coming up behind you, and they're just not going slow. And I think what really needs to happen more than anything else is that people who are using electric assist bicycles or vehicles need to learn that if you're going to be riding with other people or people that are walking on these multi-use trails, whatever, they need to slow down when they get to them. And they have enough power that they can go back up to their speed when the coast is clear. But it's really, really important that when you're going by a pedestrian, that you go by them at more of a pedestrian speed pace, or at least have alerted them properly before you go by them. But you really shouldn't be buzzing them like you're in a car, because what's the difference? Or my solution to the problem, if you can go as fast as the cars can go, then get out the car lane where you belong. That's my feeling. But anyway, that's enough of that. So this is not good for anybody in the bike business. This is not good for anybody who is riding on an e-bike. And there are so many e-bikes out there now, so many people that are actually benefiting from this, because now they have inexpensive transportation that is reliable. And it's just really a problem that I see in the future. So hopefully it will not get passed. And e-bikes are essential transportation for many workers, and licensing, insurance, and registration requirements create financial barriers and pretexts for unnecessary law enforcement stops. How do you feel about that? Why don't you just tag down here and let me know what you think about e-bike legislation and where it should go, and whether or not we should be licensing and registering and insuring all of them. Eek. That's scary to me. All right, so we're going to pass on. What else do we have here on the the list? Okay, this actually came off of, I think this actually came off of a Reddit list, and it was a bike lane blocking pickup truck on which is a familiar sight and how cyclists can fight back. So I know you've seen it. You're riding on this bike lane and you're in a relatively busy area, a city atmosphere, whatever it may be. And you're riding down the bike lane and all of a sudden there is a pickup truck or other large type vehicle. Maybe it's a delivery vehicle, UPS truck, a mail truck, whatever. And they're parked right in the lane. And where do you go? Well, you can't go to the right because if you go to the right of them, you're going to hit the curb and the sidewalk. So that's not going to work. But if you go to the left of them, what are you going to do? You're going to have to swing out into traffic. And it's just annoying as all get out. And it's place that really strikes a nerve to those of us who actually use bike lanes as a positive way of transporting ourselves. So anyway, so this post is the vehicle blocking a bike lane, forcing cyclists and even cars to merge into traffic. The poster's dry caption, bonus points for blocking half the car lane too, captured the absurd yet oh so familiar behavior. A single move, the driver managed to endanger cyclists, frustrate motorists, and underline how casual bike lanes are still treated as optional space. The post struck a nerve. Hundreds of upvotes followed, along with comments from riders recounting how the same behavior snarls traffic for everyone. What almost no one expected, however, was enforcement. The assumption earned through repetition that nothing meaningful would happen next. The expectation is well-founded. While blocking a bike lane is illegal in Toronto, like it is across North America, enforcement remains inconsistent and largely reactive. By the time bylaw officers arrive, the vehicle is usually moved on. Over the years, cities and advocates have floated a range of solutions to close that enforcement gap, some modest, others more radical. Among the most talked about and now largely forgotten were bike lane bounty programs. Bounty programs, interesting. In 2022, Austin, Texas briefly explored the idea of paying residents to report vehicles blocking bike lanes, inspired by similar programs in New York City. Under the proposal, residents could submit photo evidence through the city's 311 app, and with the reporter receiving a portion, typically around 25% of the resulting ticket revenue. Oh, I love it. The logic was straightforward. Cities were already struggling to enforce parking violations at scale, while residents encountered them constantly. Why not harness that visibility? Supporters argued that it was no different from programs that already pay citizens to report illegal parked cars in accessible parking spaces. Critics worried about vigilantism, administrative complexity, and political optics. The proposal was approved at the commission level, renamed, debated, and then quietly stalled, like similar ideas elsewhere. It generated headlines, sparked debate, and ultimately faded without being widely implemented. The disappearance of bounty programs says that as much about the political discomfort as it does about the logistics. Paying people to enforce bike lane rules forces cities to admit to uncomfortable truths that bike lanes are routinely blocked and existing enforcement isn't working. It also reframes the bike lane obstruction not as a minor nuisance, but as a violation serious enough to warrant incentives and accountability. Into that vacuum stepped a more organic and more durable system of documentation and pressure. Platforms like Bike Lane Uprising have transformed everyday frustration into structural data. founded in 2017 by Chicago cyclist Christina Whitehouse after a near-fatal encounter with a truck blocking a bike lane. Bike Lane Uprising allows riders across the U.S. and Canada to report obstructions through a dedicated mobile app. Those reports feed into a central database used to identify repeat offenders, problem locations, and systematic failures. Unlike one-off social media posts, Bike Lane Uprising's data has been used in court cases to pressure companies whose vehicles repeatedly block bike lanes, support new legislation, push cities toward safer infrastructure, what bounty programs promised in theory, scaling enforcement through public participation. Bike Lane Uprising has achieved indirectly through persistence, credibility, and data. And just like Bike Lane Uprising, some commenters suggest that reporting that any bike lane infraction could lead to change or at least more enforcement and more resources dedicated to enforcement in the future. Social platforms such as Reddit, Instagram, and X are still playing a role too. The next step may be less resurrecting bounty programs, maybe less about resurrecting the bounty programs and more about integrating what already exists. So anyway, interesting. Bike Lane Uprising. I might have to take a look at that for a future show, just so we learn a little bit more about that, because that sounds like kind of an interesting idea. This is especially interesting if you live in a big city, I'm sure. And so anyway, bike lane blocking. Lovely, isn't it? Isn't it great? All right. So what else do we have here? So if you're a follower of, Dubai. So Dubai, obviously with more money than they know what to do with, due to it being a United Arab Emirates faction of the world, they have created a 93-kilometer air-conditioned cycleway dubbed the Loop. Nice, huh? So Dubai, a city in the United Arab Emirates, known for luxury shopping and very modern architecture, is working on a scheme called The Loop that would connect more than 3 million residents to a healthy mode of transport, namely walking and cycling. The Loop is a 93-kilometer climate-controlled cycleway and pathway system. Boy, it must be nice to have a lot of money. Dubai has a new 20-minute city initiative, and the Loop is part of a major effort to make cycling and walking the primary mode of transport for daily commutes for more than 80% of residents by 2040. This isn't such a bad thing. So the other features of the Loop include the following: zero emissions transport system, 100% renewable energy using kinetic power from flooring. Interesting. 100% recycled water for irrigation. Additional amenities for residents, promotes health and well-being activities, and vertical farms for food safety. Very, very interesting. There's a concept video here of the Loop, and it looks like you're inside of the structure, which looks like a greenhouse of sorts, and there's all sorts of vegetation in there and walkway, and on one half of it, and on the other half of it, it's all bikeway. It's very cool. It is definitely very, very cool. If you want to see this, then I would recommend that you go to momentummag.com and you can watch the video that they show, which is it's a conceptual video of what they're going to be doing in Dubai. And it does seem like an interesting idea. Now, if something like this were to take effect and become popular, depending on what city you're in, it could be a great way to shift from car-centric infrastructure into people-centric infrastructure. So it's kind of a cool thing. It looks intriguingly interesting from the outside. It looks like a giant snake kind of working its way through the city. It's really cool looking. And so anyway, I just thought it was kind of cool, and I would bring it up because it could become the first active mobility infrastructure of its kind anywhere in the world, with various amenities and sustainability features that will shape the future of urban mobility in Dubai and possibly beyond. What do you think? Neat idea, huh? I think it's a neat idea. So anyway, let's move on. Let's get out of there. And let's look at what Belgium is doing. So Belgium is betting big on bikes, and Antwerp is already showing how it can work. Now, if you're a big fan of Belgian cycling, and you know, obviously cyclocross is a big thing right now, you'll know that there's a very, very strong cycling contingent of people in the country of Belgium. If you want a glimpse of where urban cycling in Belgium might be headed next, you want to look to Flanders. The northern region of the country just unveiled a cycling master plan with a bold target: by 2040, 30% of all trips should be made by bicycle. It's an ambition that puts Flanders and fairly in rare company internationally, and just not talk. It's one of the largest cities. Antwerp has already cracked the global top 10 of the Copenhagenized Index, showing that this is a shift that is well underway. In December, the Flemish government announced that a new cycling master plan with a striking goal by 2040 of 30% of all trips in Flanders should be made by bicycles, for a region better known internationally for ports, logistics, and medieval city centers more than bike highways. It's a confident statement that's not just coming out of nowhere. So it's pretty cool. So what is the... Let's switch gears here a little bit, and we're going to go over to the 30 most popular, most bicycle-friendly cities in the world that are ranked. I think I've been through this before, but it is it's worth bringing this up because there is actually a list which is called the Copenhagenize, and it's a global standard for cycling that was made in 2025. And the first one is a name which I cannot pronounce properly, I'm sure, in the Netherlands. It's Utrecht, Netherlands, and it is the number one on the top, showing what happens when a city is built around bikes. Nearly a third of all trips are by bicycle, supported by calm streets, protected lanes, and bicycle priority corridors. With, 63 euros per resident invested annually, the city provides more over 100,000 parking spots, including the world's largest indoor bike garage. And I have talked about that in the past. So number two on the list, Copenhagen, Denmark. Long set the standard for cycling cities: 52 kilometers of protected bike lanes, 100 kilometers of roadway, and 29% bike modal share. Recent innovations include bicycle streets in dense corridors, and where wide lanes and green infrastructure support high cycling volumes while managing rainwater. The city invests nearly 38 euros per resident annually into cycling, maintaining consistent growth and high infrastructure density. This is not a lot of money, folks. It's really not. This is like pretty reasonable if you take a look at it from a reality standpoint here. And it's trying to make car-free zones that are near schools, ensuring and near shopping and that sort of thing. And next is Ghent, Belgium. And Ghent is number three on the list, focusing on taking car-focused streets and making them into calm, livable spaces to make cycling safe and accessible for all ages. These are things that are going on around the world. Policy support is strong, with active advocacy and long-term investment, ensuring that cycling remains a core part of the urban life. By combining infrastructure, governance, and culture, Ghent demonstrates how a mid-sized city can lead into a cycling innovation and offer a model for others worldwide. Number four on the list is Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And it tends to also be one of those global benchmarks for cycling, where bicycles dominate daily life and 30% of all trips are made by bike. Its mature network handles vast volumes with precision, and the city continues to refine safety, calm streets, and cycling culture to meet new challenges from e-bikes, congestion, and tourists. Number five on the list, and we did have a little highlight on this a few episodes back, Paris, France. Paris has transformed into a cycling city. How did that happen? Well, I'll tell you how it happened. COVID happened, and COVID transformed Paris into a much more bicycle-friendly city than it had been in the past. And even though cycling is such a big thing in France, Paris was not a very cycling-friendly place at all. And I know people who have been to Paris, and they said driving a car in Paris is not a friendly thing to do, let alone trying to ride a bicycle there. So anyway, but Paris has moved into fifth place, going from 5% to 11% of all journeys in just 5 years. Strong political commitment and a rapidly expanding network of protected lanes have made cycling central to the city's urban renewal, demonstrating that historic streets can accommodate modern mobility while preserving their charm. Okay, next on the list is Helsinki, Finland. Even in the winter, Helsinki prioritizes cycling, clearing snow from 150 kilometers of bike lanes. With extensive separated lanes, traffic-calm streets, and new parking garages, winter riding has never been easier. And number seven on the list is Munster, Germany. A compact university town, 40% of the streets have protected lanes and dedicated bike lanes painted red to signal priority. Public bike counters display daily ridership, encouraging more locals to pedal. And then, of course, eight is Antwerp, Belgium. And so we just talked about that, so we're going to switch over to that. And number nine is Bordeaux, France. Again, we're talking about Bordeaux, which has converted former car lanes into continuous green-framed bike tracks with cargo bikes handling deliveries and extensive bike batteries. The city supports both commuting and urban logistics on two wheels. Also in France, Nantes, France, the they got bike routes all across the city, low speed streets, car free areas, 1200 square secure bike spaces at the main train station, and a growing cycling culture. Number 11, Bonn, Germany. And Bonn is upgraded from painted lanes to protected lanes, raising its bike mode share from 15% to 21% in 7 years. Speed limits and traffic calming encourage the safer streets for cyclists. In number 12, The Hague in Netherlands. With 80% of the streets under 30 kilometers per hour and programs like the Den Haag Fiets for kids and families, The Hague is investing heavily into connecting suburban routes and providing secure bicycle parking. Strasbourg, France is number 13, and it is networking links into their metro area, supporting cargo bike deliveries, encouraging new riders through bike-to-work challenges and abundant parking. Lyon, France is number 14. Montreal, Canada is number 15. They're leading North America with bike infrastructure, with cohesive protected lanes, record-breaking Bixi rides. I'm not sure what a Bixi ride is. Must be one of their systems where you can sign up for and pick up a bike anywhere. Anyway, and North America's first bicycle streets. St. Denis Corridor alone hit 1.3 million trips in 9 months. Yay, look at that. Wow, there's some great pictures here. And then we go, number 16 is Malmo, Sweden, 27% bike mode share. Munich, Germany is building a bike highway network, and their cycling mode share rose from 18% to 21% from 2019 to 23. Oslo, Norway prioritizes safety with Vision Zero policies, 30 kilometer per hour speed limits. I like that one a lot. Snow-cleared lanes and winter bike tire subsidies. No kidding. Cool. Vienna, Austria, they just added 44 kilometers of bike routes in the last 5 years, including its first Dutch-style bike street. Subsidies for cargo bikes, school training, and bike festival foster citywide cycling culture. Number 20 is Bern, Switzerland. They have 18 kilometers of protected lanes, bicycle streets, 2,600 station parking spaces. Cargo bikes are common. And Graz, Austria, with 130 kilometers of cycling paths, pedestrian bike bridges, and education programs. Graz nurtures riders of all ages and aims for 30% bike mode share in the next 5 years. Zurich, Switzerland is number 22, converted a former car tunnel into a bike-only corridor, added color and coated pavement for easier navigation. It requires all students to pass a cycling exam. Ooh, like that. Mode share rose from 8% in 2019 to 11% today. Number 23 on the list is Rotterdam, Netherlands. Number 20, I'm going to breeze through the last few of these. Ljubljana, Slovenia is number 24. Bologna, Italy, number 25. Stockholm, Sweden, number 26. Victoria Gasteiz in Spain is 27. And Wrocław, Poland is 28th. Quebec City, Canada is 29th. And Vancouver, Canada is 30th. So there they are. There's your 30 most bicycle-friendly cities in the world by Momentum magazine. So kind of cool. So we got some cycling news here. Bicycle racing news. First of all, I don't know if you heard about this, but Wout van Aert and of course Matthew Vanderpool have been at each other big time in the cyclocross races, and it's the classic two who used to be youngsters that were out dominating the cyclocross world. They're still dominating the cyclocross world. Matthew Vanderpool just got a bonus because Wout broke his ankle. So it was a snowy race. He went down hard. He cracked his ankle. And here's the big story. The Belgian superstar sustained a small fracture during Exactacross at Mall, and he is back on his bike only 10 days after surgery for ankle fracture. So he posted the 33-kilometer ride on his Strava account, calling it Monday's victory, quote-unquote. Despite the fact that the ride was his first since surgery, he still managed a personal best on the Heiderief climb segment, though he was way off his overall best time. So his arch rival Matthew Vanderpool is still just rocking the cyclocross world. He's winning everything in front of him. He's really doing a great job. But anyway, that's it. Wout van Aert is back and he is ready to go. And he plans on getting into the European Classics that are coming up, pretty soon. It's all right around the corner, folks. And then what else do I have here? Yao Almeida is ready to step out of Tadej Pogačar's shadow and take on Jonas Vingegaard in the 2026 Giro d'Italia. Yes, it has been announced that Jonas Vingegaard is thinking that the the Giro is his next mission to accomplish as far as cycling goes, and we'll see how that all works out. And you know, we'll see what Jonas's fitness is like. Jonas has been a big time, let's say, sound machine for bicycle safety, and boy, the Giro is like one of the worst as far as that goes. So I hope he knows what he's getting himself into there. But the Giro can have some of the most classically difficult descents of any of the races out there, and not to mention some of the most amazing climbs too. I always look forward to the Giro because the Giro is just like, it is my favorite race of all. But anyway, we shall see what it is going to look at, because Yao Almeida is going to skip the Tour de France and he's riding the Giro and also the Vuelta in 2026, and we'll see how that works out. So that's about all I've got time for, folks. So I think we are just about there, and we're going to have to move on to saving the date, right? The Giro. I know, it's early. It's early. Friday, May 8th to Sunday, May 31st in 2026. There's the 2026 Bicycle Leadership Conference in the United States in Dana Point, California. Put on by People for Bikes. You might want to check that out if you're really big into getting to involved more in bicycle advocacy, etc. The Tour de France will be from July 4th to the 26th, and it's going to kick off in Barcelona, Spain, and concluding its traditional finish at the Champs-Élysées in Paris. So lots of good bicycle racing coming up, lots of big time bike racing happening in cyclocross right now. The World Championships is right around the corner. Big shout out to our buddy Lizzie Gonzalez over in Belgium right now, as she is racing in the Belgian circuit along with a number of U.S. riders. I see a lot of little U.S. flags popping up. So, you know, thumbs up and a tip of the cycling cap to those of you who are taking on the crazy European cyclocross season from the U.S. And so always give us your opinion. This is Finishing Points. Bicycling is freedom. Life is better for everyone when more people ride bikes. Cycling is an easier and safer option for more people, because when people ride, people are happier, they're healthier, our communities are safer and friendlier, our planet is greener. And together, we can work and help more people know the joy of bicycling. I'm going to say it again. It won't be my last time. Get loud. Get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, the price of gas, and lack of places to safety ride, and do your part. And hey, take on that Pedal and Run Challenge. Consider parking the car or truck for one day. Just one day. Ride your bike instead. You will surprise yourself. I always used to say you just may surprise yourself. I'm going to say you will surprise yourself. And remember, when you're riding, whether you're riding your bicycle or driving a motorized vehicle, please be safe and kind. The views on this program, the views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You've been listening to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. If you're watching on Facebook Live, please feel free to comment down here below. And you can also send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. If you want to contribute information, drop me an email. This is Pedal and Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down, the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Get on your bikes and ride!